I feel guilty whenever I'm happy. How can I be a high-functioning person? My kids were killed. It feels wrong to me. How can I feel pleasure? I have a lot of rationalizations that help me. It's like, I'm not really honoring them if I'm lying curled up in a ball in my bed. I'm much more honoring them if I'm out in the world talking to somebody about them. I also want to live a life that honors them. They were cool, badass kids. They were funny. They had dark senses of humor. They were like warriors for social justice. So I got to get up off my ass and do something that helps other people.
What's up, Dead Talkers? It's your boy, David. How y'all doing? I'm doing great. Thanks for asking. Today, I had the opportunity to speak to Colin Campbell, who lost both his teenage children, Ruby and Hart, when a drunk driver crashed into their car. Now, I know that's a heavy start, but this was an amazing conversation to learn from a man, a husband, and a father who lost both his children, and what it takes to get through that, and how he's continually getting through that today. He offers some really sound advice for what works for him, practical modalities that I feel can apply to so many things we go through in life. So I hope you enjoy this episode. It was a really honest conversation, and Colin is a gem of a man. Other than that, I did launch a Patreon account. Just want to plug that real quick. It's only $5 a month if you want to support the show. If you want to get some bonus content, go check out the link in the description. You will get a free 7-day trial as well in case you want to test it out. But it's $5. Don't you go to Starbucks? You get your coffee every day. It's $5. $5 coffee. You can support the show and mean the world. And as usual, I will stop talking. Let's get into the show. I know the word memoir, but what is that? What is the biggest difference that that's just like, it's like journaling or is like, how would you describe it?
Yeah, I don't know yet because I just started, but you know, the book that I wrote is really more like self-help. Okay. So it's literally there as a very practical, you know, hopefully compendium of tools to help people who are grieving. Whereas this book is going to be more just my thoughts about fatherhood.
Okay, so more on the fatherhood approach, or are you relating it to being a father that's lost a child?
Yeah, absolutely.
Specifically, okay.
Because it's we are fostering to adopt two kids, two teenagers.
Oh, amazing.
And so it is. I find it to be kind of insane emotionally what's happening, because I'm grieving while fathering at the same time. So I've got kids who are in Ruby and Hart's rooms, but they're not Ruby and Hart. They're these other kids who I can't say their names because we're still foster parents, but we're moving towards adoption, hopefully. Hopefully the courts will let us. But it's such an extreme experience that very few people lose teenagers and then foster adopt other teens because it's really rough.
I'm sure. How long has it been, just to clarify, so Ruby and Hart, your daughter and son?
Yeah.
How long ago did they die?
They died. They were killed in June of 2019.
Okay.
So almost 5 years.
Do you mind sharing what exactly happened?
Yeah. No. So we were driving to Joshua Tree, which I don't know if you know or not, but it's this beautiful place, mm-hmm. The high desert. Right?
I love it there.
Yeah. And we love it there too as a family. We went there all the time. Like, at least once a year, I think we went to Joshua Tree, and all of us loved it. And Ruby was 17, and Hart was 14, and we were actually driving up there because we had just made an offer on a vacation home there, this sweet little house like in the side of a hill with amazing views. And we were driving up. It was kind of tragically this spur of the moment decision. I was going up. It was going to be just me. I was going to drive it by myself to go because I wanted to put a pool in. And I wanted to talk to the pool guy if that would be possible or not. I didn't know how it would work. And then my wife said, let's make it a romantic getaway, just the two of us. And that's great. I got a babysitter all lined up. And then Ruby found out. And she's like, whoa, you can't go there without us. And I chose where the pool was going to go. So you got to take me. So then Ruby and Hart joined us and we drove up. And a drunken high driver going 90 miles an hour T-boned us. And she was so drunk and so high, she never touched the brakes. So she hit us full speed. And Ruby and Hart in the backseat were killed.
Oh, man. Was it instant?
Yes. I'd like to think it's instant in the sense that they never regained consciousness. They never breathed again. So they were killed on contact.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Probably I phrased that wrong. I meant, was there any prolonged time period after where you were hoping of their survival or anything like that?
Well, there was. We were hoping only because EMT came and they whisked them off to the hospital. So it took a while before we were officially told that they were dead. But we kind of knew it, but we didn't know it. We were knocked unconscious in the crash. We came to discover Ruby and Hart motionless in the back seat. And the drunk driver's car was on fire. And it was an intense scene. So I think in our hearts, we knew they were gone. But then it was strange because there were EMT working on them and then whisking them off to the hospital. But
oh man, do you remember the short, I say like that moment it happened, the afterwards that you just explained into that first day, what was going through your mind with such a traumatic event like that, where you're seeing your children in such a state?
Yeah. I think it was a lot of disbelief, and then just horror. I'm living in a nightmare. So it felt like I was in a nightmare. And it was very hard to live, like just to be. It was difficult. I don't know how to explain that, but it was not like we were contemplating suicide, but it was very hard to just be in that reality and to try to understand and accept that this is real, this is really happening, and then how would we live without them? How is that going to be possible?
What are those first steps? I mean, not to say there's a playbook by it, but what were your first steps, the days coming, the weeks after, the months after? Like, what was that process? Let's say the day one without your kids.
Right.
What is that process?
Well, we stumbled in the front door, and I think it was early in the morning. The crash was like at 10 o'clock, and then Gail and I had injuries. Gail had broken ribs, a cracked sternum. I had cracked ribs, a lacerated kidney, and there were some issues with us, but they released us from the hospital. They didn't want to, but they released us so we could go and say goodbye to Hart. Hart was on life support at another hospital. So we were told that Ruby had died and that Hart was being kept alive and we had to go now. So we, again, no one told us he's going to die. They just said, you have to go now. And so we were sort of left thinking, okay, is he still alive? That's strange because I didn't see him breathing, but okay. It was strange how they sort of doled out that information. So we get to the hospital and then they don't tell us there at the check-in. They just turn ashen. I'm like, oh, go to the third floor. And we go to whatever, the third floor. And we're told to go into this, you know, the counseling room or whatever that is. And there's a social worker there. And the social worker comes and doesn't tell us
what
that Hart's dying. In fact, the social worker starts talking about the Ronald McDonald House and how you can stay there for free for up to 5 weeks. And we're really confused. We're like, is he alive? What's happening? And then the doctor came in, and the doctor was amazing. I mentioned her in the book because she's the first person that sits us down and tells us straight out that, well, we already knew that Ruby was dead, but she tells us Hart is dying from 3 life-ending injuries. So it's impossible, right? 3 he's killed 3 times over, basically. And then she says, tell me about Ruby and Hart, which I thought was just this amazing gesture because everyone's avoiding us. Everyone's backing away. They don't want to talk about it with us. You can see them looking away. And then suddenly this doctor is like leaning into it because she knows by asking us to share about Ruby and Hart, she's willing to sit with us in our grief. And I thought it was an amazing gesture because it gave us something to do. Like we could talk about Ruby and Hart to her as opposed to just wailing incoherently, right? So that was one of the first lessons I learned about grieving, the power of sharing, the power of talking, and of leaning in, of not being afraid of the pain.
Even right off the bat, you know, you just look, it literally just happened. And even that occurrence seemed to have made a difference, let alone the long-term effects, I guess, of processing it that way.
Yeah.
You know, I find that, I mean, I don't know. When you tell me that story, you're just putting me in a place. I could see how it would be almost like an outer body experience, not understanding that this is reality. Because if something like that happens so quick, you know what I mean? It goes back to that same discussion of when you know someone's going to die or something as shocking as that event, your body just goes into complete shock. It's like a grief cold plunge where it's like, how do you, it's almost too much to process at once. So over the next coming days, weeks, months,
what is that between you and your wife? Because your whole life is just shifted upside down.
Yeah, really shattered, I'd say. Our lives shattered. And the fact that we were also injured sort of on the surface added to the confusion. We were knocked unconscious. So there's that extra element of what's happening. And I think we kept saying to each other, like, you know, is this real? They're gone. How? You know?
Was that part, was there a coming to moment of accepting it and kind of that blend and transition of what doesn't seem real to reality? Was there a kind of coming to realization moment where it all hit you, or is it?
I think you get hit over and over and over. And I remember feeling like I had to say goodbye to Ruby and Hart over and over and over.
Internally or?
Yeah. That in other words, you know, stepping into their room for the first time.
Right.
Oh, you know, goodbye. Looking at this particular picture for the first time, I've got to say goodbye again. Talking to a friend, I've got to say goodbye to Ruby and Hart. It felt like I had to say goodbye to them every time I experienced anything new or re-experienced something old, if that makes sense, because they weren't going to be part of that.
Yeah. Is that grieving essentially your old routines? It's grieving the future of raising your children.
Right.
And then there's the relationship aspect of just you and your wife. Like, what worked for you in regards to losing both of your children in one accident and moving forward, grieving not only individually, but grieving with your wife? What was that process for you from then to now?
Yeah. But first, I want to say real quick, I don't refer to it as an accident. I call it a crash because the woman who killed my kids didn't accidentally become drunk and high and then accidentally get behind the wheel. She made those choices. Right.
That's a whole other layer of the conversation of dealing with that, I'm assuming.
Yeah. So, an accident implies like, whoops.
Right.
But here it was a deliberate choice to be a danger on the road, right? Mm-hmm. And then we were in the crosshairs. But now I've forgotten your question. What did we do?
What is life grieving losing your children? And how do you process that? And what is getting you through it?
Yeah. Well, I want to give a shout out to the Jewish traditions of mourning. They really helped me in so many ways. So I'm not Jewish, but my wife is Jewish, and we raised Ruby and Hart as Jews. So they were bar and bat mitzvahed, and we're active members of our temple, and our temple was extraordinary. You know, our circle of friends were also extraordinary, but there's some extra level of production that goes into supporting people in grief. There's a meal train got set up, and all my friends, I remember, were complaining to me. They're like, we signed up as soon as we could, but all the slots were filled for like months. Like, what is it with this with this synagogue? Why are they hogging all the spots? Basically, they really like came in and were like extremely supportive. But a lot of the Jewish traditions literally taught me how to grieve. So, for example, you asked about acceptance. I still don't fully accept that this is real, that my life is real, even though it's been 5 years now. There's definitely a part of me that feels like this is unreal, because how could they be gone, right? But, for example, in the Jewish tradition, the burial itself, we, mother and father, we literally buried Ruby and Hart with our bare hands. So we reach in to the dirt and we throw the first chunks of dirt onto the casket. And then we sit and watch as our entire community continues to bury our kids. And everybody comes and takes shovelfuls. And at first it seemed like really cruel that we have to sit and watch this long process. But I didn't want to leave. But that kind of in your face, it seemed to me like it was a lesson in leaning into the pain of it, like not trying to live in denial, because part of me wants to, right? Part of me wants to just sort of imagine they're still here and this is not real. But then here I am sitting for a long time watching my kids be buried. So that was very powerful. And then Shiva is immediately that night. So Jews bury the dead very quickly after the death. So it's not, so they were killed on the 12th, pronounced dead on the 13th, and then we buried them on the 16th, Father's Day.
Wow.
And so it was a very quick, very fresh in the grief process, and then Shiva starts that night, and people gather in your home, in our home, every night people would gather, and that for a whole week, 7 nights, except not Shabbat. And that was a powerful experience because I didn't want that to happen, right? What do you mean people are coming to my house right now? I'm in another altered state. I can't have people gather around. But then I discovered that I wanted to. I wanted to talk about Ruby and Hart.
So these methods, I'm sure there might be more methods, but these two I want to tap into real quick. So you're saying it helped you lean into the pain as opposed to denying it and avoiding it, mm-hmm. and essentially do a couple things that you innately didn't want to do, but you learned they both are very healing?
Yes, and the thing I didn't want to do was be in community. So the big lesson I learned was that we grieve in community. We don't grieve in isolation.
What was it about community that made you not want to be a part of that? Was it just you didn't feel like just dealing with people? You didn't want to be seen like this? What was it?
Yeah, I think at first it seemed like a social burden. Like here I am struggling. I had no appetite. I'm walking around the house like a zombie. I don't know what to do. And now people are coming. That seems antithetical to what, but I discovered actually it was so helpful to me to see other people grieving Ruby and Hart. So I told stories, Gail told stories, my wife Gail told stories about Ruby and Hart, and then their friends came up and told stories about Ruby and Hart, and our friends told stories about Ruby and Hart. And that was kind of amazing because here we are laughing and crying together.
So was it the positive angle of good memories that shifted the mood? Because I feel like it could maybe go either way where you don't want to hear the memory. Like some people might not want to hear the memories. I don't want to hear stories because they're gone, and start taking mm-hmm. that angle, which I could understand.
Yeah.
But was this just a simple shift of the mood, or was it something different?
I think it was different. I think it wasn't about shifting our mood so much as allowing us the space to express how we felt. So all day we're bottled up. I felt bottled up. I felt like lost and churning these thoughts, like what's happening to me? And then suddenly I had an audience and I could talk about what was happening to me. And then I could just talk about how great Ruby and Hart were. You know what I mean? That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to talk about how fucking amazing my kids were, right?
And that the process, did you just explain that, just a few days after it happened, was this a continual reoccurrence of mythology of, approaching your grief?
Yeah.
The community, the talking,
yes.
The facing the pain.
Yeah. And what I found was Shiva ended and everything shifted, because during Shiva, there was structure and people knew how to talk to us. They were told, right? This is what you do. You follow the griever's lead. You come to the house. You show up and we talk about Ruby and Hart and grief. And then Shiva ended and people didn't know how to talk about Ruby and Hart anymore. They were scared that it would trigger me.
That's interesting. When you put in that environment where you're told what to do, and then outside of that, it's as if something changed.
Yeah, yeah. I think we fall back on the fear. Hmm. Like it seems scary to talk to someone with dead kids. I don't know what to say.
Do you think that is like they're getting authorization to talk about it? So it gives you a permission to, oh, this is what's supposed to be done. So all of a sudden, it just goes back to now. I don't know if they want to.
Right. Yeah.
Something changed.
Yeah, I think our culture, we get so many messages that people in grief don't want to talk about it, that it's like a taboo subject, that it might make them cry, and that would be terrible. And I discovered, like, well, I'm going to cry anyway.
Yeah, might as well just do this shit together.
Right, right.
But at the same time, it's like you even said yourself, initially you didn't want to talk to people about it. So with the instincts of other people to not want to bring it up because of XYZ was essentially correct in your sense until you were put in a situation where, it's more orderly and organized and this is what you're supposed to do. Yeah. So did you revert back to not wanting to talk about it? Or you were like, no, I need this shit.
Yeah, that was a very early wake up call for me of like, oh, I'm not going to avoid the pain. I don't want to do that. Like I thought I did, right? I thought I want to avoid the pain, but no, I want to feel the feelings because I want to think about Ruby and Hart. Because the alternative is I have to shut them out of my mind, right? I have to compartmentalize that and like not think about them. Because if I think about them, it's going to cause me some pain. even if it's joyful memories.
What about your wife? Because that's a, when you lose children, you know, there's that dynamic of, you know, you're going through it with your partner and you have to be selfish and look after yourself. But in this case, it's two of you grieving. So what is that dynamic of being in a relationship with someone with, you know, your wife or your husband and vice versa and coordinating dual grief and then your relationship? So what was it like for you and your wife?
I think we were grieving remarkably similarly. We were on very parallel tracks, certainly in the beginning. I remember taking walks with her and we were just like literally having the same thoughts, the same memories, the same disbelief, whatever it is. Like, so that was kind of amazing. And we both wanted to talk about Ruby and Hart in our grief. I think that's really was helpful in an amazing way. I think when one person in a couple doesn't want to talk about it, that's when I think it's really difficult. Because I don't know what I would do, what I would have done if Gail didn't want to talk about Ruby and Hart, because I needed to desperately. I still do. I still talk about them all the time, and so does she. And so I'm so grateful that we both on that track. And sometimes we would be in different places, right? Sometimes one of us would feel a lot of despondency, right? And the other one would be more ready to engage. And that seemed okay, actually, because we could look at the other person and be like, oh, okay, I'm going to claw my way out of this despondency. It's going to pass, and I'll be in a different place in my grief. So that was complimentary in a good way.
So in regards to when you had those little, when you weren't exactly on the same page, which is understandable as well, even though you just tapped into it, what do you do when you're, if you're, so hypothetically, if I've relayed someone that's listening right now, I might have lost a child, and it causes friction in the relationship because maybe they're just on two opposite sides of the spectrum in the grief and the way they're handling, which therefore affects the relationship and understanding each other. What can you do, in your opinion, when you do hit those moments for people that maybe on a grander scale are constantly just grieving differently, not on the same page, someone wants to talk, someone doesn't want to talk? What is that process, in your opinion, to a relationship that is kind of clashing in their grief process and causing friction in the relationship?
Yeah. Well, I have a kind of radical take on it all. Kind of leave aggressive each other. Take on it all. No. The opposite, which is that I think that we all grieve the same, ultimately. I think we get told over and over again, everyone grieves in their own way. You do you, whatever you do is right. And that's what grief is. And when I read that in all these grief books, it kind of pissed me off, because I was like, I don't need permission to grieve however I want to grieve. I need some advice. I need some guidance here because I'm lost. So telling me whatever I'm doing is great is not helping, right? <That's> I don't know. It's like, what's supposed to happen here? And I've come to believe that actually we all grieve the same. And that grief process is engaging with the loss in whatever form that takes. So talking about the person we've lost, drawing, singing, whatever it is, writing, but it being engaged in grief is how we process the loss. How can we process loss if we're compartmentalizing it and boxing it up?
So when you're saying engage in grief, like, is the layman's terms of just don't avoid the pain?
Yeah, and let yourself talk about it. So for your example of a couple that one is not talking and one is talking, and there's incredible friction there, my advice is let's get the person who's not talking to talk about it, because that's how we grieve. We all avoid grief. I avoid my grief all the time. We have to. We can't be like sitting nonstop in agony and grief. We have to be in this life as well, right? But if we're compartmentalizing that loss and just trying to keep it bottled up so that we can be in this life, it doesn't work, because there's that pull. We're living a fake life in a way, right? We're in denial. We're like, I believe that if we allow ourselves to talk about the loss, that allows us to be more present, actually, ultimately, in this life.
Does the conversation evolve? Like, at some point, like, what do you, obviously you're talking about memories, this or that, or is it just strictly talking about how you feel today? Like, how does that conversation change? Or is there redundancy in the conversations and talking about it? You know what I mean? It's like, I think about my father, it's like, what the hell am I going to talk about? Like, where does that conversation go? Like, I'm actually curious about the specifics of what you do when you talk about it, if there are even steps.
Yeah. I don't know if there's steps, but I think it does evolve. I think it changes. I think it's a mixture of like memories, which can feel redundant, right? Because we're saying that story yet again. But that's what I'm thinking about right now. I'm thinking about that story again, because look at this, right? Here we are at the beach again. So how, of course, I'm thinking about the time I was with Rubin Hart, this beach, swimming here, whatever it is, right? And so it's so great to be able to say the same story again to Gail. But also, I think it's so helpful to talk about how do I feel right now in my grief about those memories.
How do you do that? You just sit and allow yourself to feel and try to identify it? What does that mean?
Yeah, I think just share the feelings. Allow yourself to feel the feelings and then share them. I don't know.
I agree. I mean, I think that's a big thing about the healing is, again, it kind of is all encompassing of what you just said, but it's allowing yourself to feel it. It's so easy. The easy choice is to push it aside. I've always said that. It's like the easy choice is to avoid it. The hard part is facing it, but we're shooting ourselves in the foot by not allowing ourselves to face it.
Yeah.
And do you have any feelings towards that process of healing, for lack of better words? Does that ever feel like a guilt trip of, because I'm going through this and I'm healing from it, and now I'm like, oh, that's, I have to forget my kids now, like obviously it will never happen,
right?
But you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, of course.
Healing is like a guilt, like I don't, if I heal, then how am I as a father not going to feel pain about my kids and that whole guilt shit?
Yeah I think that's a constant. That's a constant with me. I think acknowledging it helps me. It's like, yeah, I feel guilty whenever I'm happy.
Yep.
I feel guilty when things are going well and I'm functioning. How can I be a high functioning person? My kids were killed, right? Mm-hmm. It seems like it's like wrong. It feels wrong to me. How can I feel pleasure? Because I spent so much time thinking about this, I have a lot of rationalizations that help me. It's like, you know, Ruby and Hart love me. they want the best for me. I'm not really honoring them if I'm lying curled up in a ball in my bed. I'm much more honoring them if I'm out in the world talking to somebody about them, right?
Amen.
And so I want the world to know about Ruby and Hart, and that won't happen if I'm in a ball in bed. And so I also want to live a life that honors them. They were cool, badass kids. They were funny. They had dark senses of humor. They were like warriors for social justice. So I got to get up off my ass and do something that helps other people.
Do you go down that path of, you know, that why path and think about such a terrible event and just think like, what the fuck? Like, do you ever philosophize the reasoning behind it? Even though it's obviously an answer that, you know, you're throwing dust in the air and where the hell it goes. But do you ever go down that rabbit hole of why such shit happens?
Yeah, I don't. I really don't. Part of it's because I'm an atheist.
Okay.
So we raised Ruby and Hart as Jews, but I'm an atheist. I'm a Jew adjacent atheist,
as they say.
But I read a study actually when I was writing my book. I was reading about all this, and I read a study that said, and it's just a study, so who knows? But they looked at people who asked the why question, and looked at people who didn't ask the why question, and they tracked them over time. I'm going to get the statistics wrong, but basically the people that asked why so much, they had a harder time of it. They had a harder time because sometimes they would like find, you know, an answer, I guess, a little bit, but wasn't satisfactory. And if they really were invested in trying to find out the why, over time, those people just had a harder time in grief. It's very unsatisfying, I think.
Yeah, I can see how it could be unsatisfying because, I mean, even though some people believe it and, you know, believe they have the answer, they know. And I think that might be the difference as opposed to the idea. I wonder if it's asking the question why, or as opposed to just not finding a concrete answer. Because there are some people that believe they have an answer, and then they probably grieve better because I'm going to see them again, or however you want to do it.
Sure, sure.
I posted on Facebook a question, like it was last minute, so I didn't gather enough. But I was like, hey, I'm speaking to a man. I don't want to say your name too early because I didn't get your permission. But I was asking a man who lost his kids, what questions do you have? And one woman, I think it was Deborah. And she said, I could just pull it up, but she asked something like, what or when or how did you realize when your children have eternal life? And my response is like, well, I mean, you're assuming that he believes in that, first of all. So I was like, you can't just assume that. He's like, well, then I think her response was, I found that And it's ironic that you are an atheist, because you referenced atheism and saying that I found that, you know, most atheists in my experience, after having an experience like that, will like has shift your beliefs, and yours didn't. Like you don't believe in an afterlife, that your children have continued on, correct?
Yeah, not in that sense. But I do think they've continued on in the sense that I've come to realize how much they live inside me.
Right. The memories and this.
And who I am, like literally who I am. Like right. They shaped me, they shaped my wife, and they shaped their friends. You know, we've kept in contact with their friends, which is great. Difficult though, right? So their friends are getting older. So Hart hadn't even fully graduated eighth grade in June. He was about to graduate eighth grade. His friends have now graduated high school. And Ruby's friends are now at the end of college, and she was killed in 11th grade. So they've all grown up, right? And it's so hard to see them because it just makes that feel so real, the time gone. But it's also so great to see them and talk to them about Ruby and Hart and how impacted they are. So they're still sending me essays. Like a friend of Ruby just sent Gail and I this essay he wrote about, a poem about his grief, losing Ruby.
That's remarkable.
And so that makes me feel like, okay, Ruby and Hart are still in the world. They're impacting these people. Their spirits feel alive to me in that sense, you know? And I like thinking about them, you know, I like thinking about them looking down on me, but I don't actually believe that they're looking down on me. Does that make sense?
No, that makes perfect sense. I mean, they're alive through memories and the way they currently affect your life. So I totally understand that. I just always, you know, wonder and have spoke to people with similar beliefs as you. And some people believe that they're living on forever and they find comfort in the idea that they're going to see him again.
Yeah.
But I just wonder how that affects someone who doesn't believe you're going to see them again.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, to me, I'm like, then why are we're honoring them. But at the same time, if they're like, if we pass and then we're just literally nothing after this, then what are we honoring? It's like, you know what I mean? It's like if someone's looking down on you because they're still living on forever, then it's like they're aware of me honoring them. But I get what you're saying. It's a silly way for me to say, like, we're not going to honor them because there's no eternal life. Like, it's just an interesting angle of, is that healing? Or does that make you feel better that there's nothing after this? Or the idea that you're definitely not going to see them again? Like, what does that do to you?
What does that do to me? I mean, I think it's hard either way.
For sure.
Because they're not here on earth. You know, one reaction I have to that, the eternal life thing is, I think it's great. Anyone finding comfort is great.
Yeah, right? I have no idea.
I'm all for people finding comfort. But I do think that even if you do believe you're going to see your dead loved one again, there's still a grief process here on earth. Yeah, you still lost them here.
We're the ones dealing with it.
Yeah, there's no like quick fix. That's what I react to, like when people say that, like, oh, you'll see them again in heaven. Well, but yeah, that'd be nice if that's true, but they're not. I don't see them here on earth, and don't shortchange our grief. No. You know what I mean?
Amen.
We still get to grieve no matter what we believe.
For sure. Yeah. I think I can't go back to that question. And, you know, I was like, but you're also just assuming he believes in that. So it's ironic that, see, if you're listening, Deborah, I'm sorry to call you out, but I'm saying he doesn't believe it. Yeah, it's always fascinating to me. Cause at the end of the day, I guess we're going to find out or not find out one way. That's the same thing. I was like, I don't know. Whatever's going to happen is going to happen. It's out of my control anyway.
So right.
Let's deal with what we got right here for now.
Yeah.
But again,
yeah.
If those beliefs help you find comfort, then that's great too.
Absolutely.
What is it like being the parents that lost their children? Like, you know what I mean? Because I feel like, not to relate it, but to relate it, when I was growing up, I was that kid in school that lost his dad on 9/11. And it's like that weird exposure to it.
Yeah.
So like how did that affect your life in regards to maybe in the immediate aftermath? I'm sure time continues on and everyone goes back to their routines. But was there any effect on your process of being those parents in the societal eye?
Yeah, definitely. And again, this is in our heads, right? Me and Gail, because we don't know what's going on. But we felt like we were these like cursed people, that it was scary to be around us. It was scary to think about us. And by us showing up somewhere, we're going to bring down the mood, right?
And this is all how you're perceiving
this. This is how we perceive it. Yeah, yeah. So who knows? But we had the feeling of like, you're going to invite us to a party? Okay, here we come. good luck. Because it's we're going to walk in the door and people are going to be like, oh, shit.
Well, it's interesting because we were just talking about the guilt of, you know, being the grieving parent and feel guilty about you being happy. Other people might feel the same way. It's like, oh, are we supposed to have a good time around them right now? Because they're probably grieving and this or that. So I need permission to feel okay as well.
Yeah.
So there's that ripple effect outside of just being the griever.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think from my experience that actually all of that can dissipate if we engage in it.
Yeah.
So for example, the most recent case I think was when Hart's friends graduated from high school. So this was 4 months ago, 5 months ago? No, 6 months ago, whatever.
Some time ago,
their elementary school had a party. That's their tradition. So the elementary school invites back the high schoolers who are graduating to come back to elementary school and be like, oh, remember elementary school? And now you're growing up and now you're graduating. We're going to send you off. Isn't this amazing? And they didn't know what to do with us. So they very kindly wrote to us, the school, and said, hey, we're having this event. We have it every year. And how do you feel? Do you want to attend? And at first we were like, that's going to be horrible, right? Because here we are, we're just celebrating life. We're celebrating kids growing up and going off and we're all getting back together again, except Gail and I can't do that, right? But then I was like, you know what? You invited me. I'm going to go. I'm going to lean into the pain and see what happens because it was very meaningful. Reuben Hart loved this elementary school. I have so many beautiful memories of them there. All these families loved Reuben Hart. All these kids loved Reuben Hart. I'm going to go. But I was scared. I was scared. Here I'm walking onto the campus and everyone's face is going to fall, right? How could they not? And it did a little bit, but not really. Everyone rose to the occasion, I felt like, and we all were able to have real conversations and I could be there to celebrate their kids. And they could also talk about Hart and how much they missed Hart.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to that. I think maybe you're showing your engagement by just showing up and then how you're acting and your mood and still celebrating everyone else. That is important. I do it in a much sicker way where I usually crack it. I throw in a joke and then just... But a joke is also for my own kicks because I like people's reactions when I throw a dark joke when it comes to death in general.
Yeah.
But it's also like taking the gloves off, loosening the tie, and show. I think you word even better. I haven't really thought about the engagement, even though I feel like I do it. Actually, I think engaging in death is literally in the title of my show, so I don't know what I'm talking about. But it's like that. It's showing that it's okay, and I think by initiating that engagement, lets the guard down everyone else, and they can be more loose and more natural and not overanalyze how I should be around someone, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So it's like, I think I always consider saying, I think it's up to the person grieving also to, sometimes, if you feel like you're not getting something from other people because other people don't know what to do, it's like, maybe you can make a step in that engagement pathway and initiate that to show I'm okay with it.
Right.
And kind of give them that indirect permission. If you're not just going to say it, like some people just express your mind, say, I would like to talk. But some people also, it's like a two-sided thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it's like a delicate balance, I think.
Yeah. Well, that's literally what my book is about.
There we go. Perfect transition.
It's titled Finding the Words. And it's actually designed to help grieving people find the words to talk about their needs to their community.
So
that's the main thrust of the book.
Finding their words. So it is that initiation of engaging with other people.
Yeah.
And is it two-sided, your book, in regards to obviously for the griever, but is it beneficial for people that are helping people grieve?
Yeah, I've found that people have said that. They've said they've read my book and they found it really helpful because they could understand what's happening in the griever's mind. Because I also talk about that, like what was going on in my head? What am I dealing with? And so it was an eye-opener for people to better understand their friend who's grieving.
Yeah, I just had David Kessler on the podcast.
Oh, nice.
I'm not sure when this is going live, or I'm pretty sure David's episode will be out by now by the time we put this out. But it was that conversation of, I think I asked him how important the conversation of death is for people that haven't lost someone particularly close or truly felt deep grief. And it was in relation to what we're discussing now. That's like, and it was a good point, and it was a logical point. Yeah, maybe you haven't lost one, but I guarantee you probably know someone that has. And if you don't know someone else, you're going to. So whether death is going to affect you and you want to avoid it for your own personal emotional feelings and fears or whatever it may be, or just discomfort, it's like, you know, getting the arsenal together about grief, loss, and experiencing death you might have to be there for someone else. And knowing those tools by maybe reading your story or hearing your story or your book, I think that is, again, something that can be easily avoided for someone who's not grieving or just doesn't want to face it. But if you do look at it at the lens of, oh, if I, you know, expose myself to the conversation of death and loss, I may be better equipped to be there inevitably for someone else.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are you tapping into that a little bit?
Yeah, I think so. I think educating our culture in general, you know, it's called dead talks, right? What we're doing right now. Yeah. That's basically what it is. Like, let's talk about it because it makes it all less scary for everybody. Because without that, there's this white elephant in the room where no one's talking about what's actually happening, right? Somebody's grieving a loss. That's all they're thinking about. If they lost someone who they loved, you know, a month ago, a year ago, that's kind of all they're thinking about. And if they're not allowed to talk about it, then whatever's happening in the room is not real.
Right. And how are you today? Almost five years.
I go up and down. I have a lot of hard times where I'm just like overwhelmed with the grief and the pain. But I don't mind the pain. It's kind of like a companion. It's like Ruby and Hart accompanying me. There's an aching, if that makes any sense.
No, I get that.
It's like, you know, if I cry on a day, I usually feel good. It's like, yeah, I'm in touch. I'm opening my heart to all the feelings, and that feels healthy. And I like thinking about Ruby and Hart.
Does that go back to the question of guilt in regards to you attaching your aches and pains to your children, which obviously it is, but is, maybe unless I'm misunderstanding, is it associating that pain with them maybe put you in a place of not wanting to let go of that pain?
Like, yeah, kind of what we said earlier. That's a great question. And I do talk about it in my book because I did wrestle with it.
Did I write your book? What's going on here? Just teasing.
No, but you know, because you've gone through it, right? That's why we have a shared knowledge of.
Yeah, in my way, as you've gone in your way, you know, it's like I brought that up again with David. It was when you share your story, it's like I can only understand it through my lens and through my experience of grief. And there is that foundation of, you know, the camaraderie. I think that's why the grief community or any community of trauma, like a specific traumatic event or whatever the heck we've gone through, even if you're just a Jets fan, like there's a community, that camaraderie of understanding the pain of being a Jet fan. and it's like there is a common bond there, even though every experience is so different. You know what I mean? I don't even have children, let alone I never lost children. You didn't lose your dad in 9/11, but there is that, like, it's like a mutual respect, or like, it's like you can look at each other and nod by saying, I get it, but I don't get it. Because I haven't been in your shoes. I haven't been in your grief.
Yeah.
But there is that commonality of grief of just being like, you know, this person, you know, you've been through it.
Yeah.
And I see you, I hear you.
Yeah. There's a baseline of empathy that shoots way up, I think.
Yeah. It's a baseline of empathy and also a chaotic trend of just, you know, I still don't know. I don't know your variables, you know, your relationship with your wife, the relationship with your kids, the timing in your life, what else do you had going on? There's just so many crazy variables that affect everything we do that you can't shed light on it because there's so many different variables. Mm-hmm. But it's like it's so bizarre how easily tweaked we are. Just like how you were that week, something could have happened that affected the way you handled that, let alone in your childhood or what's coming up and the relationship with this person and I got a athlete's foot. I don't know. It's just like there's so many different things that just this crosshairs are going through. And sometimes to me, it's hard to even tell, do I feel this way because of that big thing? Or is it also underlying with this and that? So I think it is important to examine, but not over-examine. I'm keep referring to the last episode. There's just so many goodies in there, but like that you can examine. I think it's important to examine your life and examine how we feel this or that, but it's also a line of over-examination where it's like, okay.
Yeah.
It's like find that sweet spot. I think it's important to be introspective, but also not go too far because you're going to drive yourself off a wall.
Right. Well, to that point, to your question about the pain, there was a time early on in my grief where I did almost lean too far into the pain. I sort of associated, I became guilty if I wasn't in pain. I think what you're talking about, that idea that like I'm only honoring them if I'm feeling agony, right? And then I had further realizations and like, oh, that's not actually, I want to open myself to the pain so that I don't have to stay in the pain, so I can let it go in a way, so I can access more joy and have a better time, if that makes any sense.
No, that makes sense. I mean, this might be a weird way to compare it because it has nothing to do with biological loss. But when I think about like my last relationship, my ex, like there's still, I've gotten rid of a lot of things, but there's still a couple things, physical things. This is right. Be a silly notion, but like physical things, whether it's one photo or a photo frame or two, like a, that I just haven't fully got rid of. And when I see it, I feel a pain. Uh-huh. And I also don't want to get rid of it because of the pain, even though I want to get over the pain. Uh-huh. But I want to keep that reminder of the pain. And the pain is just tied to, you know, my last relationship. But I don't want to let that go. And I'm like, even though it hurts, then it's like real. I feel like by getting rid of this physical item, it's truly gone. And maybe you're not talking about like a physical item, but that, like that pain that we hold on to is a reminder of something even like great that we had.
Yeah.
And then by getting rid of that pain, it's like truly gone. And then when it's truly gone, that's freeing and you're getting rid of the pain, but then there's that more pain. Like, what the fuck is going on? It's a cluster shit.
Yeah.
I don't even know. I think I just got like an R.L. Stein novel out of my mouth right there. I don't know what the heck I just said. But yeah, it's confusing. And I think it's amazing what you're doing. And I think, again, I thank you for being willing to talk about it. You know, yeah. I'm sure there's thousands and thousands and thousands of fathers that have lost children and mothers.
Sadly,
that
yeah.
don't know what to do. And I think it's nice to see you sitting there and gotten to where you are almost 5 years later. And obviously it's still a process, but I think it's important to see someone 4 or 5 years ahead of someone that's going through it right now.
Right.
Even though it's not you and different variables, to see, okay, you know, he was in a dark place just like I was,
yeah.
you know, tomato, tomato, but he got through it in many capacities, still getting through it. So it's good to see the future self through someone else sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's helpful to keep in mind that, you know, the pain and the aching doesn't just magically go away, but our relationship to it changes. It definitely changes. Mm-hmm. It becomes something different, much less scary, much less awful. And yeah, we're able to live with loss, right?
Yeah, sometimes we have no choice and some people don't want to live with loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the scary part when I see people that are in that mindset.
Yeah.
Sometimes
yeah.
it is temporary. Like, I think you can understand that it's just a point right now. And it honestly does get a little better. Some people get frustrated and say it doesn't get better. It does get better.
Right.
I think it gets maybe easier to deal with. I don't know the right words, but
yeah.
something does evolve in you where you're able to deal with it. So I think, I wonder if people convolute, like, it gets better with moving on. Like, that's a weird word that people don't like either.
Right.
But I think it does get easier.
Yeah, I don't even like the word healing, actually, for that same reason.
I don't think I really heal. Not saying that word. Healing is a weird word, too.
Yeah, well, no, some people like it. It's all good. It's whatever works for you. But for me, it doesn't work because I have two holes in my heart, and they're not going to go away. But I like the idea of living, finding life around it, expanding the heart.
You know, someone once said to me recently, and it kind of relates to what you're saying, that you have two holes in your heart for your children. It's like he said it's like a tree that got struck by lightning, and there is that the ash and the lightning strike in the center of the tree. The tree didn't get knocked down. The stump's still there. The roots are still there, and the tree eventually starts to learn how to grow again, and it grows this really thick bark and a beautiful tree around that lightning bolt of the tree. But in the core of that tree, there's still that ash. There's still that lightning bolt mark.
Yeah,
there's this beautiful thick. Strong tree with beautiful leaves grown around it. So even though the wound isn't healed, there is a sense of healing around that wound. And I feel like that was a perfect example of not naming what you're feeling again, but just reminded me of that analogy that you had, the holes are still there, but you're growing this strong bark and these roots around it that continue to grow into a beautiful tree.
That's beautiful. I love that tree analogy.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking at the tree right now. There you go. Look at you. I can't see your lightning bolt mark, but I know it's there. So I commend you for everything you're doing. So before we get out of here, let people know about your book.
Oh, yeah.
And what else you got going on. I'm going to show it to the camera while you talk. Oh, so feel free to plug yourself.
Yeah. So, yeah, I wrote this book, Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose, Penguin Random House. And it came out in March. And I'm very proud of it. I've gotten great feedback from other grieving people and people who love grieving people. Found very helpful. It's very practical.
Love practical.
Yeah.
This shit.
Yeah. Great. Right. So part of the one moment Gail and I had, we were leaving a grief group together and it didn't go well. I love grief groups, but this first one didn't go well. We went a little too early and we weren't ready for it. And we stumbled out into the parking lot and Gail wailed like, how will we live? What will we do? And that stayed with me. Like, what are we doing here in grief? And so I sort of took that tact in the book. So I have very practical, like, things you can actually do as you grieve that helped me. And so, it's very practical.
I love that, Colin Campbell, finding the words. Thank you for sharing some of those words in this podcast today. I really appreciate it, man. Thank you for taking the trek over here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This is great.
All right, another episode of Dead Talks, as usual. You can find the links to Colin's book and information on him in the bottom of the show. And if you haven't signed off yet, write me a damn review. Give me a good review. 5 stars. If you don't want to write a 5-star review, then just don't touch it. Thank you, and until next time, Dead Talks. See you guys later.